The Civil War, Part 4, In Camp. Routine was the word for camp life for both Federal and Confederate troops. Combat was one of the few breaks in this routine, which consisted in large part of drill, marching for the infantry, and mounted exercises for the cavalry. As one soldier put it, the first thing in the morning is drill, then drill, then drill, then drill again. Then drill, 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 a little bit more drill, then drill, and lastly drill. Between drills we drill, and sometimes we stop to eat a little and have roll call, and then drill. The routine of drill was broken from time to time with free periods. During these periods, soldiers entertained themselves with talking, music, particularly singing, writing letters and keeping journals, and baseball and other games. Reveille and the day begins. When troops in both Northern and Southern armies were not on the march or in battle, they spent their days essentially the same way. They got up early, 5 a.m. in the summer and 6 a.m. in the winter. Drums for the infantry or bugles for the cavalry sounded reveille, and the soldier or cavalryman had 15 minutes to wash and dress before assembly of the company or cavalry squadron for roll call. Anyone missing was put down for extra work or other punishment. The first sergeant read any special orders for the day, and then the infantry and artillery went to breakfast. Before they could eat, however, the cavalry had to feed and groom their horses. Then, after washing up and breakfast, the men walked their horses to the nearest stream or pond so their mounts could drink. Chores and drill. For all units, no matter the service, camp chores such as chopping firewood and policing the grounds occupied the first part of the morning, as did sick call. During this time, each company or squadron, first sergeant, gathered those men chosen for guard duty and turned them over to the regiment's corporal of the guard. Each guard stood or rode sentry duty 2 out of every 6 hours for the next 24. Those not assigned to work parties or guard duty spent the rest of the morning drilling. These exercises, generally company or squadron drills, but sometimes regimental, included marching and riding in formation as well as weapon practice. Confederate cavalry units were not as given to drill as Union cavalry, or, for that matter, Confederate infantry. Some Southern cavalry commanders, such as Nathan Bedford Forrest, thought such workouts a waste of time and a drain on men and horses. Others, however, like Jeb Stuart, drilled their troops hard. Day's end. Lunch, known as dinner, was called at noon by drums and bugles playing roast beef. Following lunch was some free time and then more drill, with late afternoon devoted to tent inspection and a second watering of the cavalry's horses. At 5:45 p.m. came retreat, which consisted of an inspection and a dress parade. Each soldier and cavalry trooper carefully checked to see that his weapon and buckles were polished, his belt and other leather items shined, and his uniform brushed. At retreat, officers read out orders, messages from Army command, and court-martial results. Then the soldiers went to supper, except the cavalry, who first had to feed their horses. After supper, a soldier or cavalry trooper, who was not on guard or a work detail, was free to talk, play cards, or get up in a baseball game. At 8:30 p.m., he had to report to a final assembly and roll call known as tattoo. A half hour later, taps sounded, and the enlisted men had to be in bed with lights out and no talking. Those caught breaking the curfew would find themselves slated for extra work. Although officers were supposed to obey lights out, many did not, for the Union Private John Billings observed, "Here, as elsewhere, rank interposed to shield culprits, and officers did get together, make tenfold the disturbances ever caused by the privates after hour." Sundays in review. Sunday was the only day of the week on which this routine varied. After breakfast, the privates of both companies and squadrons prepared for the formal regimental inspection. The regimental commander, or his junior officers, came to each unit's site, examining quarters, the cooking areas, and grounds. In what was called the knapsack drill, each man's effects were also inspected. The remainder of Sunday was free time, although in some units, particularly Confederate, attendance at religious services was mandatory. The cavalry had less of a break than did the infantry and the artillery on Sundays. As on any other day, the horses had to be fed and watered twice a day. And, of course, guards from all units, no matter the service branch, had to be posted. Other breaks in routine was the occasional brigade or division review. The men of each unit spruced themselves up and marched or rode past the brigade or division commander and his staff. Then the troops demonstrated a variety of marching or riding maneuvers. Reviews were generally ordered when important visitors, such as senior Federal or Confederate Army officers or governmental officials, were present in camp. Sometimes the events were a way of boosting morale, as Jeb Stuart discovered. His Confederate cavalry brigade put on a series of elaborate reviews in which the unit's horses were groomed to a brilliant sheen, boots and sabers polished, and dress uniforms exhibited. Stuart's men would then do riding tricks and stage mock battles, all of which went down well with both participants and observers. Password 7. Living in tents. No matter what the day, except when in battle, three things were uppermost in the average northern or southern soldier's or cavalry trooper's mind: sleep, food, and free time. Federal and Confederate troops slept in tents, except during the winter. For the first year of the war, the standard issue was the Sibley, a large conical or bell-shaped tent, some 12 feet in height. Its 7 square feet of floor space housed 4 easily, but often as many as 20 men were forced to share a Sibley. Sleeping in a circle with their feet pointed toward the center, the soldiers were so crowded that, as one Union soldier observed, if one wanted to turn over, he would yell out the order to flop, and all would go together. Few soldiers liked the Sibley, with one Confederate calling them those abominations, those breeders of disease. Because they were so large and heavy, the Sibley tents were hard to transport, and their use was discontinued in 1862. Replacing them was a shelter half, nothing more than a sheet of canvas 6 feet by 4 feet. 3 shelter halves were fastened together to form a wedge with one open end that barely accommodated 3 men. The resulting tent was known as a dog or pup tent because the soldiers joked only a small dog could live in one. Sleeping in a dog tent during rain was very uncomfortable. For like all Civil War tents, water eventually soaked through the canvas and dripped onto the occupants. Additionally, wind and rain often blew in the open end, which some soldiers partially blocked off by hanging coats and blankets. At the height of summer, these tents were stifling hot. Some soldiers pitched their shelter tents so that the sides did not meet the ground, allowing for air circulation. Shebangs and log cabins. Tents were much more common among the Federals than among the shortage-plagued Confederates. Some Southern soldiers slept in pairs, sandwiched between blankets on the ground and another on top. Others cobbled together a hut called a shebang, which could sleep 4. The shebang could be thrown together in a day and had a wood frame hung with pieces of thin boards canvas, blankets, bushes, or whatever else was at hand. During the winter, when combat generally ground to a halt because of cold, rain, and snow, Federals and Confederates alike set up more permanent sleeping quarters. Several men would get together and build a little log cabin, the logs placed either horizontally on top of one another or vertically like a fence. The roof was made of boards, thatch, or fastened together shelter halves. The men plastered mud between the logs to stop drafts and to trap heat. Lastly, the cabin owners used more logs to build a fireplace, sometimes even with a chimney. The fanciest of the cabins had interior walls creating rooms, signs, and beds. Over the entrance of tents and cabins were crudely lettered boards announcing that one was entering Hawkins' Happy Family, Fifth Avenue Hotel, Social Circle, Old Abe's Parlor, Chateau de Salt Junk, or whatever other whimsical name struck the occupant's fancy. The inside could be neat, cozy, or messy, although during rains, particularly intense, all interiors became wet and muddy. The beds that soldiers and cavalry troopers used were as varied as the men themselves. One Federal soldier wrote, "A spreads his blanket upon his tent floor and uses his boots for a pillow. B nails up a long, narrow box, strongly suggestive of that unpleasant black-looking shell or coffin in which we all sleep our last slumber. Another makes his couch a small cedar, twigs carefully laid one upon another, while he who is most fastidiously or picky drives into the ground four forked sticks, rests upon them two slender poles to which a number of barrel staves are fastened crossways, and spreading his blanket enjoys a bed as luxurious as any that crowd the warehouses back home. Messmates. Password 3. Tents and cabin mates and their neighbors commonly group themselves in informal arrangements known as messmates. The members of a mess ate together. Collectively, they drew several rations at a time, and because neither Confederate nor Federal ranks included cooks, in most messes, each soldier did his own cooking. Messmates clustered together because they were lifelong friends or because they had similar tastes and interests. They sometimes gave their group a name and each other nicknames. Thus, one mess in the 82nd Illinois became the Hyenas, with members being called Elephant, Bulldog, Clipper, Greyhound, Weasel, and Tiger, among others. Rations. It was no great feat for the average Civil War soldier or cavalry trooper to cook for himself. Rations were simple and easy to prepare. Both sides ate mostly the same kinds of food, although the Confederate Army generally issued smaller portions and more often ran short. In camp, the troops ate bread, salt pork, or bacon, beans, dried potatoes, dried vegetables, coffee, sugar, salt, and vinegar. Occasionally, cattle were delivered to a unit for butchering. Salt pork or bacon were fried in a skillet, often heavy with grease, or skewered on a bayonet or sharp stick and held over a fire. Vegetables came in a small, pressed block that was cooked in boiling water, as were beans and potatoes. In general, the rations on both sides were terrible, particularly meat, which was frequently rotted and full of maggots. Salted meat was so full of salt that it was sometimes inedible, even after having been soaked in fresh water for hours. Pickled beef was often rancid. Even freshly butchered meat could not be trusted. Soldiers reported having seen slabs of newly cut meat left hanging so long that they became covered in flies, while others watched butchers throw the meat into the mud and dung of slaughtering pens. Hardtack and cornbread. The bread supplied to both sides also had its problems. Normally, Union troops dined on hard bread, more like a large, thick cracker called hardtack. Hardtack was often moldy and filled with weevils or maggots, leading to its being called worm castles. Some soldiers would sometimes crumble it into a cup of boiling coffee and skim the weevils off as they floated to the surface. Another favorite way of cooking the crackers was to fry them in pork grease and make a dish called skilligaly. Hardtack was tough chewing, and leg ends grew up around it. Legends grew up around it. Soldiers claimed that their teeth hurt for days after eating it. Others said that even soaking it in coffee for 6 weeks would not soften it. Crates of hardtack bore the mark BC for brigade commissary, but the soldiers joked that it was the date of its manufacture. Southern soldiers ate mostly cornbread, made from a coarse grain that produced a rubbery bread. Like hardtack, military cornbread produced its share of myths. Soldiers claimed that it could be stretched into ropes or formed into balls that bounced. Cornbread was often made into cakes called slapjacks, which were cooked over an open fire. Confederate soldiers also used it to make a dish called kush or slosh. Into a skillet would go all the meat that a mess had, then grease, water, and cornbread were added and cooked until the mixture was thickened up. Kush was an easy meal to make, if not a particularly digestible one. Coffee. If the food was bad, the coffee was generally good, at least in the North. Union soldiers loved coffee, and each one carried a bag of coffee beans, which he crushed with his rifle butt. During any free time, Federals turned to building fires and brewing coffee. It was the mainstay, observed one Northern soldier, and without it was misery indeed. A fellow Federal claimed that to a soldier, coffee was considered to him indispensable as the air he breathes. Consequently, the Union Army made sure that even if no other rations were available, coffee was. The Army was experimented with instant coffee, which was a mixture of coffee, milk, and sugar. 1 teaspoon of this coffee essence, as it was called, made a cup of coffee. However, the soldiers did not like it, and the Army stopped issuing it. Confederate soldiers also liked coffee, but it was in short supply during the war because of the blockade. Its presence usually meant troops had taken coffee beans from dead or captured Federals. Most Southern soldiers made do with coffee substitutes made from peanuts, potatoes, peas, corn, or rye. Tobacco. In addition to coffee, tobacco was one of the great pleasures of a soldier or cavalry trooper's life. It was smoked, chewed, and snorted with relish, particularly among Southerners who ranked it in importance just behind food. Although the men of both sides used tobacco, Confederate use was much greater since, being a major Southern cash crop, tobacco was so much more readily available in the South than in the North. Federal soldiers noted that tobacco was so common that even women chewed and smoked it, as did some children, a practice almost unheard of in the Union. However, as the fighting dragged on, the supply of Southern tobacco dwindled, as tobacco fields were occupied by Union troops or left unplanted because of a shortage of farmers. Confederate troopers complained bitterly of the rising cost of tobacco and the increasing difficulty of obtaining it. More than one Southern general wrote Richmond demanding that his troops be given first shot at available tobacco supplies. The plant eventually became an important form of barter among Southern soldiers. Reading and writing. Coffee drinking and tobacco use often accompanied off-duty activities. It was during free moments that soldiers wrote letters home and, more importantly, read and reread letters from home. They also recorded their day-to-day experiences in diaries and journals that remained among the best sources of what Federal and Confederate Army life was really like. Although Union soldiers had a higher literacy rate than Confederates, reading was an important diversion for troops in both camps. Reading material was also frequently scarce, and consequently the troops would read anything. Favorites were newspapers, particularly the illustrated, or picture papers. Some Union and Confederate regiments published their own newspapers, either using portable printing presses or writing them out by hand. During the course of the war, some 200 of those homemade papers circulated among the two armies, some lasting only one or two issues, others several months. They bore such titles as Buck and Ball, Camp Kettle, Unconditional S. Grant, and Pioneer Banner. Books were also prized, and the works of Milton, Swift, and Cooper, among many others, fueled literary discussion groups. Even more popular were Beadle's dime novels, sensational thrillers about frontiersmen and Indian fighting. Thousands of these flooded army camps, north and south. Regardless, it was the Bible that was the most widely read book among Federal and Confederates. Racing, snowballs, and baseball. Civil War soldiers also formed debating clubs and amateur theatrical productions to pass the time. Tall tale spinning was always popular, as were general bull sessions. Wood carving of everything from pipes to chess pieces occupied many a soldier's free hours, and in all units could be found checker and chess players. Sports, from wrestling to foot races to football, were also popular among Northern and Southern troops. Cavalry units, North and South, enjoyed horse racing. Southerners added spice to their contests by conducting them within firing range of Union sentries. Giant snowball fights between regimental companies during the winter were also a favorite activity of Federals and Confederates alike. The most popular sport, however, was baseball, and pickup games were common in both armies during warm months. Two versions of the game existed during the war. One resembled the modern game with a four-base diamond and three outs per inning. The other had two bases, one out per inning, and a rule that after hitting the ball, the batter, known as a striker, could keep running between bases until struck by a thrown ball. Each circuit of the base was a scoring point, and consequently, scores in this baseball were often high. One game reportedly ended with a score of 66-20. Gambling and drinking. Betting on the outcome of baseball games, wrestling matches, and horse races was widespread in both armies. When no other contest offered itself, soldiers would place bets on racing louse. Each soldier would place a single louse on his tin plate, and the first louse to move off the plate was the winner. Soldiers in the 1st Tennessee Regiment discovered that Private Sam Watkins had fixed the winning streak of his louse by secretly heating his plate before the race. Card games such as poker, 21, faro, euchre, and whist went on in every camp, and it was a rare card game that was not played for stakes. A particularly popular form of gambling was a dice and board game called Chuck-a-Luck, whose players bet on a combination of numbers showing on three dice dropped through a funnel. In one Confederate regiment, a private relieved a number of his fellows of their recently received back pay with Chuck-a-Luck. Besides gambling, soldiers sought relief from army life in drinking. Although gambling and drinking were violations of Federal and Confederate regulations, both were difficult to control or prevent. In particular, this difficulty arose from the sheer prevalence of these activities. In some units, one Union cavalry trooper wrote his family that our camp is infested, more or less, with gambling and drunkenness. Moreover, officers who were supposed to enforce anti-alcohol and anti-gambling regulations were themselves drinkers and gamblers. The popularity of gambling and drinking notwithstanding, the most common form of diversion in the Northern and Southern armies was music. Many soldiers on both sides carried and played musical instruments, and many companies and regiments had bands. One Confederate brigade routinely woke to a band concert. The youngest members of these bands, and indeed of either army, were the drummer boys. They ranged in age from 9 to the early teens, and despite their name, were just as likely to play the bugle, or fife, as the drums. In some cases, drummer boys were officially attached to a company. In others, they were unofficial members, almost mascots of companies and regiments. These young boys often became the stuff of legends. Will S. Hayes' popular song, Drummer Boy of Shiloh, supposedly recounts the brave death of Henry Burke of the 58th Ohio. However, the only Henry Burke on the regiment's rolls was a private who enlisted 2 years after the Battle of Shiloh. A Henry Burke on the Shiloh Memorial was added, it turns out, after Hayes' song became a hit. Still, some drummer boys did have heroic adventures. One boy named Charlie Common, after losing his drum, grabbed the rifle and fought alongside the 52nd Ohio at Perryville. And Orion P. Howe of the 55th Illinois was wounded while carrying messages during the siege of Vicksburg. John L. Clem was the most famous drummer boy of the war. As a 10-year-old with the 22nd Michigan, Clem's drum was smashed by a shell at Shiloh. Clem was unhurt and became known thereafter as Johnny Shiloh. Although still technically a drummer boy, Johnny fought at Chickamauga, where, when ordered to surrender by a Confederate colonel, the young boy shot the man off the horse. After the war, Clem tried unsuccessfully to enter West Point. Finally, with the help of President Ulysses S. Grant, he became a second lieutenant in the Army, from which he retired in 1916 as a major general. Soldiers sing. With or without bands or musical instruments, the Civil War soldiers and cavalrymen sang. Southern and Northern troops sang to entertain themselves, to relieve homesickness and loneliness, and to raise their spirits before a battle. They also sang as they marched, the cadence of the songs helping them keep in step. Many songs of the period were favorites of Federal and Confederate troops. Indeed, the unofficial national anthem of the Confederacy, Dixie, had been written 2 years before the war by Dan Emmett of Ohio. Jefferson Davis had Dixie played at his inauguration, and Abraham Lincoln had it played when news of Robert E. Lee's surrender reached Washington, D.C. The most popular song among the troops was Home Sweet Home. Other favorites included John Brown's Body, Maryland, My Maryland, When Johnny Comes Marching Home, and hymns such as Old Hundred, Amazing Grace, and Rock of Ages. Publishers of the North and South did a booming business in sheet music and song books of soldiers' songs. Several collections, including The Song of the South, General Lee's Songster, Beadle's Dime Union Songbook, and Yankee Doodle Songster were marketed directly to the troops. Even today, much of the music is still played and sung. The most famous song of the Civil War was the Battle Hymn of the Republic, written by Julia Ward Howe to the tune of John Brown's Body. Howe's lyrics were first published in the Atlantic Monthly as a poem in February 1862, where they were quickly picked up by Federal troops. During the Battle of Gettysburg, Union inmates in Libby Prison in Richmond were told by their jailers that the Confederacy had won a great battle. They were overjoyed when an African-American slave who brought them their food told them that their jailers were lying. Some of the prisoners began singing the battle hymn of the Republic, all joining in on the chorus, "Glory, glory, hallelujah," and making the prison ring with song. Getting together. Northern and Southern soldiers sometimes sang competitively. A Confederate lieutenant wrote his family that we are on one side of the Rappahannock River, the enemy on the other. Our boys will sing a Southern song. The Yankees will reply by singing some tune to Yankee words. At one point, while still camped across the Rappahannock from the Federals, Confederates sat on the riverbank and listened to a concert given by a Union regimental band. From time to time, a Southern soldier yelled a request across the waters, and the Northern band played it. On occasion, unofficial truces would be called, and the two sides would actually get together to sing, to talk, or to share a meal and coffee. Such affairs were an extension of the thousands of times that Federal and Confederate sentries posted near each other would share tobacco, food, coffee, and news. Historian James I. Robertson writes, "These opposing forces spoke the same language. They had the same likes and dislikes, the same backgrounds and cultures, the same roots in American soil. Kinsfolk fighting on opposite sides promoted fraternization. So did camp boredom and war weariness as the struggle dragged on. Common desires among soldiers for Northern coffee and Southern tobacco contributed to friendly relations. And because the Civil War had much idle time between contests, anger was difficult to sustain and ample opportunity existed to become acquainted with the counterparts across a field or a river. However, such friendly gatherings of Confederates and Federals were short-lived. Soon enough came the orders to return to war, and the soldiers and cavalry set off to the next battlefield and a very different sort of meeting."